So let me just introduce him, and then he'll start. So Brian is a, he's, for the past 8 years, Brian has led the Litt Larson World Laboratories Vulnerability Risk Assessment Program. And that provides multidisciplinary assessment of threat, vulnerability, and consequence and across a variety of sectors that include electric power, oil, gas, water, chemical, aviation, rail, maritime, telecommunications, and national icons and other classified sites. And so he has actually assembled and led security teams for the 2002 Olympics, the California energy crisis, and the 9/11 response. So, with no further ado, I will introduce Brian.
All right, thank you very much. Can people hear me at the other sites?
Yeah.
All right. Folks here can hear me, I assume. All right, I'm going to try to play with this notebook technology here. Hopefully it works. Thank you, Christine, and she'll give me a first page of my notes there. As Christine said, my name is Brian Lopez. I've been at Lawrence Livermore National Lab for 15 years. I spent the last 8 or 9 years leading the Vulnerability and Risk Assessment Program, the VRAP program. And education, I got some of that, in computer science and in rhetoric as well. So a little of the ancient, a little of the new, so there's some hope for humanities folks who might still be in here after about 2 hours of pretty technical talk. And I'm going to try to talk about vulnerability, threat, vulnerability, and consequence, risk assessment at a little higher level than what you've heard so far today, and talk a little bit about methodologies that we use and how we organize around some of the challenges that were talked about in specific earlier. My program does a lot of work for Department of Homeland Security, Department of Energy, other agencies, etc. But I wanted to start by talking a little bit about personal connections to terrorism and talk a little bit about how I came to be in this job and in this role. And I think, for starters, I'll talk about high school. And I went to high school in the 80s in South America. And I grew up with insurgents and coups and the rise of drug cartels, all of which employed terrorist tactics, as did the government against them, and as did many of those groups against each other. So that was sort of my introduction to that sense of day-to-day uncertainty in living in that kind of a world where, you know, what's happening day-to-day is not necessarily safe and is not necessarily known. In the early 90s, I lived in England, when the IRA was blowing up train stations and the like, and so I experienced that. And I've also spent significant time in Euskera, which is the País Vasco, and so I'm familiar with the ADA situation there, if you folks have studied that in any of your classes. So as terrorism has made its way to the United States, I haven't been surprised by it with the experiences I had leading up to that, but I do really feel a sense of loss. You know, this the sort of the uncertainty and the diminished freedom that I've always associated with other places has now come here. And, you know, it's really come home. And so it's really been different for me having been to those other places. This was always a problem that was somewhere else. And now to have it here has been an interesting experience. So that's a little bit of my history, some personal precursors to my involvement at the laboratory with counterterrorism. But I didn't actually join the laboratory 15 years ago to work on counterterrorism. I joined for probably a bigger picture reason, to do multidisciplinary work, to do a mix of thinking and doing. You know, to have I like the academic side of the thinking and the theory, but I also like to go out and do things and interact with the real world, and I get information and I get inspiration and ideas out of real situations, real people in the real world. I wanted to have the opportunity to make an impact both at a national and international level, and I thought the laboratory afforded me that. And I wanted to work in a variety of spheres, not just one thing, like the business world. I was interested in working in science, government, in the business world. The laboratory allowed for all that, the military world, the intelligence world, and the academic world. And so even though I didn't initially join to, I actually initially joined to do something very technical for the people who are interested in the technical talks before, to do public key cryptography research, I ended up working into this in the first 5 years of my work at the lab, and so for about the last decade I've been leading threat, vulnerability, and consequence teams. But I did have some precursors, like I said, in my life, having experienced terrorism firsthand. The laboratory itself wasn't fed up, Lawrence Livermore Laboratory wasn't set up to fight terrorism, but there were also significant precursors at the laboratory, and I think you might know that from some of the previous speakers who've been here from the laboratory. First of all, the laboratory did weapons design, and if you want to think about threat, vulnerability, and consequence, you're obviously generating a very large nuclear consequence when you design a weapon. And you want to limit the vulnerabilities of that weapon for our own safety, for the safety of if someone were to steal the weapon or attempt to explode the weapon in ways that weren't intended, etc. We have a lot of special nuclear material at the laboratory, so we're very interested in protecting that material. We're interested in threats, who might want that material. We're interested in what vulnerabilities, how people might be able to access that material, and what consequences they could generate, how much of that material we want in one place, etc. We've done a lot of blast work through the years at the laboratory. The laboratory was started in the 1950s. And so that's a lot of work on consequences. And so I'm sort of trying to set up the story of, even though we weren't set up to do terrorism at the laboratory, there were a lot of precursor programs and activities at the laboratory that when terrorism really became an issue, why we were able to step forward. Radiation effects, because of the nuclear programs at the laboratory, we had a lot of information about radiation effects. Initially, we set up a program to look at nuclear proliferation. So we're interested in other states, and now, of course, terrorist groups that are interested in acquiring nuclear weapons and the proliferation of nuclear weapons, eventually transitioning to WMD, all WMD proliferation. Other nuclear things we're involved with, of course, would be nuclear power plants, safety and security of them. We set up a chem bio program, which Pat Fitch was here speaking a week or two ago about to you folks. Computer security. When I joined the laboratory 15 years ago, the group I joined, the Technology Information Systems Program group, the first thing they handed me was a book on cyber vulnerability assessment, which 15 years ago was a pretty odd topic to have a book sitting in front of me on, because that's pre-internet and pre a lot of these things. And so we were involved in computer security. We were involved in environmental threats and vulnerability and consequence with the work we did on global warming. And just in general, protecting our own site. We have a lot of security at our site. We do a lot of counterintelligence work at our site to make sure spies aren't infiltrating our facility, to make sure our people aren't inadvertently releasing information. And we do a lot of big and dangerous experiments. And so there's a lot of interest with what sort of consequences, what sort of vulnerabilities could happen when we do those. So the laboratory has been really working in threat and vulnerability in the consequence world at risk management for a really long time. It's really been part and parcel of what we do from the beginning, from an operational sense, if not specifically from a terrorism sense directly. So I'm going to start by giving you an outline of a typical assessment. So you heard a lot of technical details previously about specific things you might do on a cyber assessment within the team, but I'm going to give you more of a big picture of what a assessment would look like, not just cyber, but looking at many aspects of assessments that we do. So I'm going to break it into three phases. First of all, they're going to be pretty simple, so they'll be easy for the test. Pre-assessment, assessment, and post-assessment. How's that for easy to remember? And because I'm linear that way, we'll start with the first of the three. Pre-assessment, I'm going to start with something boring and dull but important, which is project scoping and planning. And here's where the acronyms are going to start. Some of the important things you need to think about when you're doing an assessment from a project management standpoint, from a scoping and planning standpoint, let's start with an NDA. Anyone know what an NDA is?
Non-disclosure agreement.
That was Microsoft, I bet. Was it? Yes, non-disclosure agreement. So why is it important to have a non-disclosure agreement? It's important for a lot of reasons. You want to protect the information. You're finding potentially a lot of vulnerabilities with the facility that you're working with or the agency or the company. They don't want those vulnerabilities to go to the public. A lot of these companies are publicly traded, or if they're public agencies, they have reputations. It's important to protect the information that you're discovering from that sort of disclosure. They don't want their stock price plummeting. They don't want their image plummeting, etc. So NDA is an important thing as far as project scoping and planning going. Let's go with the next acronym, SOW.
Making them work.
Statement of work, there we go. So that's another important aspect to doing any sort of vulnerability or penetration work, is having a real clear statement of work about what exactly are we going to do in this work, how are we going to do it, who's going to do it, by when, etc., which leads to the more specific part, and this really blends in nicely or dovetails nicely with some of the cyber penetration they were talking about today, which is an ROE, which stands for? I didn't hear that.
We don't know.
ROE, rules of engagement. So if you're going to do a penetration test and you're going to hack into someone's systems, you need to have a document, which is typically called a rules of engagement document, that first of all has a cutout in the company so you don't get arrested when you have your teams penetrating into the facility and they're apprehended by the guards. Or if you're hacking into the facility, their ISP isn't calling the FBI and you're not having issues like that. You need to have a cutout in the company in the rules of engagement that's going to shut down anything like that, sort of the get out of jail free card part. And you need to have a clear agreement about what you're going to do in the penetration. So you can't be randomly just attacking machines around their equipment. There may be machines that are off limits. There may be parts of their company that they want to go step by step with you. You know, if you get this far, if you get to this facility, or if your teams are able to hack in this far, we want to approve every exploit you're going to try from that step onward. We want to, you know, really be in direct, you know, minute by minute conversation of what you're doing in case you disrupt the operational work that they're doing. So those are three important things from a project scoping and planning aspect: NDA, SOW, and ROE. Let me throw a few other acronyms out at you while we're going acronyms here. And how about FOIA? Anyone know what FOIA is?
Freedom of Information Act.
The Freedom of Information Act, which is probably great for academia, but not so good for folks that you're doing penetration tests or vulnerability assessments or threat assessments or consequence assessments against, because they don't want someone through Freedom of Information Act to have access to that information. So if you're doing work for the government, that becomes an important issue if you're negotiating this sort of thing, as do other things like here in California, the CPRA, the California Public Records Act, and other sunshine laws. So in general, when you're doing threat assessments, vulnerability assessments, consequence assessments, it's sensitive information that people like to have protected legally by an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement. You want to have a clear statement of work so you know what you're doing, a rules of engagement so you have clear step-by-step as you're penetrating and attacking facilities, what's on the table, what's off the table. Can we buy fake uniforms? Can we manufacture fake badges? Are we allowed to take jobs, interview and take jobs at the company? What are we allowed to do to penetrate the company? You know, how far do you want us to go? And then the issue, if you work in government, about FOIA, about California Public Records Act, other sunshine laws become very important because you have a lot of groups, pressure groups, that will constantly FOIA, they're just phishing. So they'll FOIA constantly into government organizations, military organizations, people like our laboratory, just to see what they can come up with. Reporters do this a lot too. So it becomes a real issue, FOIA, on the government side. So project scoping and planning, not going to spend a lot of time on it, but just there's a few key things to know about if you folks go out and get into this world. The second thing I want to talk about is critical assets workshop. Let me see if I can write here. All right, the CAW. Critical assets workshop. The critical assets workshop, we didn't always do a critical assets workshop in our methodology, but we really have added that over the last probably five, six years. And it really has two goals. First, to identify the assets within the facility that are truly critical, and try to build a rationale for why we think those assets are critical. You can't VA everything, do vulnerability assessment of everything at a company or a facility or the nation for that matter if you work, you know, at the DHS level. So we need to decide what is critical, and we have a process we take people through which we call the critical assets workshop. So identify what's truly critical and don't just do that with no rationale. Build a rationale for that so in the future when they go back next year and decide to do another VA, they can say, okay, what of these assumptions have changed, and you know, is it reasonable to think that these still are our most critical items, or maybe things have changed and they aren't. Number two, to help the assessment team, as I've said, down select the number of facilities, systems, organizations, et cetera, that we need to evaluate. For the critical assets workshop, we bring together a very broad cross-section of folks at a typical facility that we'd be working with. So we're going to have cyber people there. We're going to have both cyber systems people there, also cyber security people there. We're going to have physical security people there. We're going to have operations people at that sort of a meeting. We're going to have infrastructure folks. By infrastructure, I mean people who do the voice systems, electric power, oil, gas, water, HVAC, the air conditioning and heating, transportation, etc. We're going to have field personnel. We're going to have union personnel at a meeting like that. They're going to have opinions on that. We're going to have management. You're going to have public relations folks who may have a different view of what's critical, an entirely different view. If you go talk to the engineers about what's critical and then you go talk to the public relations people, those can be widely divergent about what they think is critical in their facility. You're going to have threat people there, or intelligence folks there, if it's that sort of facility. Risk management people, internal communications people, training folks, emergency response folks, human resources folks, because we're going to look at hiring policies. We're going to look at insider threat. So those sort of issues are important. Procurement folks, we're going to be interested in the kind of procurements they're doing and what vulnerabilities that's introducing to their facility. We're going to have contracting folks there. We're interested in what they're outsourcing, who they're outsourcing that to, what background checks those sort of folks have had. Finance folks, we're interested in one way to attack a facility is to work on the money, right? There are a lot of ways to get at a facility as I'll try not to talk about all of them, but I'll talk about some of them as we go on here. So this critical assets workshop is, I'm not going to go into all the details, but basically we have a facilitated process where we rank the assets across a number of consequence dimensions. Typical consequence dimensions would be economic, so we're interested in economic consequences, loss of life. Obviously, organizations don't like to see their folks lose life. Environmental impacts. There's a lot of things you can do, say, at chemical facilities or large manufacturing plants to cause big environmental issues, water facilities. We're going to look at the legal consequences. We're going to look at regulatory consequences, public image, etc. And we're going to bring all these people together, take them through a step-by-step process, build up the rationale, and come to a consensus on an organizational-wide ranking of what are the critical assets in a rank-ordered list. And just to give you a little flavor of what does critical mean, and this becomes a big question all the time in these groups, what does it mean to say something's critical? So I'll give you an example pulled out of something we do for when we do critical infrastructure sites. We say if something's critical, it jeopardizes the infrastructure's long-term survival. So, anything that would jeopardize the long-term survival of that infrastructure is critical. If it has a serious harmful effect on operations, it's critical. And if it would require near-term, if not immediate, mitigation, it's critical. So you can kind of see I'm moving from a time scale backwards there. But those give you a sense of things that are considered critical. So we start with some project scoping and planning and get all that legal paperwork out of the way. Then we move to a critical assets workshop. So now we know it's critical. So the next thing we need is a little bit of information from the facility. So we have something called a structured information request. It's about 40 pages long. We fine-tune it for every organization we're going into, where it's just a whole gambit of questions. We're going to get the plans to every building that they have there. We're going to get all of their computer network diagrams. We're going to understand all the sewer, water, telecommunications, anything that's going in and out, all their personnel, manuals, their hiring policies, anything like that. We have a whole list of things that we do, and it's a pretty structured set of information that's divided up amongst all these different parts of these people who have come to the critical assets workshop, and then the crates of information start flowing into the laboratory with all this information. Or now that things have gotten a little more digital in a lot of industries, it used to be a lot of crates showed up, but we're getting a lot more files now. So that's sort of the pre-assessment phase. You have some sort of scoping and planning, and this is where the NDA and the, excuse my handwriting, that was, I'm having flashbacks to the, sort of third grade at Catholic school where I was very poor at penmanship. Statement of work, rules of engagement, that's where the FOIA comes in. So those are pre-assessment tasks, the management stuff, the critical asset, and the structured information request. So that's the first phase of the pre-assessment phase. Then there's the actual assessment phase, and there's four pieces to that. And those pieces are T, which stands for, any guesses? Threat. So T is threat. V.
Vulnerability.
Vulnerability, and C, consequences. So we're interested in threat, vulnerability, consequences, and ultimately risk. So this is in the assessment phase. So I'm going to break each of those down piece by piece here. So let me start with threat. So what are we interested in threat? We're interested in, first of all, we're interested in two types of threat, internal and external threat. So we're interested in insider threat, people who work for you, disgruntled folks, people who have worked for you in the past, who were fired or angry, the information that insiders could pass if paid, bribed, etc., to other individuals. And then we're interested with external threat. On the external side, we're interested in two different things. We're interested in domestic external threat, and we're interested in foreign external threat. For reasons that have to do with the way the U.S. government's organized and what do I want to say about that? We have different agencies in the United States that look at internal threat versus external threat, and you folks in the public policy world probably know more about that than me, but I just know what I can and can't do and who I can and can't talk to about what. But so we divide it into inside the company and outside the company and then domestic foreign. And when we talk about domestic threat, let me be clear that we're not talking about, you know, Al-Qaeda as the only domestic threat. We're talking about groups like ALF and Animal Liberation Front, Earth Liberation Front, eco-terrorists. We're talking about groups of disgruntled shareholders. We're talking about anyone who's a threat to that facility. So let me break threat down a little bit, and we break threat into three pieces. I don't know if anyone can read that handwriting. Capability, motivation, and intent. So capability. I'm not sure if folks have talked about this in previous talks, but capability is, you know, any threat actor, what capabilities do they have? What do they know? You know, what does intelligence show us? Do they know about cyber systems? How much do they know? What particular specialty do they have? What specialties are they trying to buy? What are they trying to learn about? You know, chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, all those sort of things. What capabilities do these actors have? Because if they don't have capabilities, frankly, you know, we don't care. We're going to watch them and try to understand what precursor events might be that they're trying to acquire capabilities. But if they don't have capabilities, then they can't access vulnerabilities and they can't create consequences. Secondly, we're going to look at motivation. What motivates these folks? And this gets a little dodgy in the intelligence world, but what are they motivated by? Are they motivated? I remember back to the first talk where Stephen was talking about how a lot of these groups are splinter groups. So some of this motivation is very interesting politics between groups and within groups. I mean, the motivation isn't always what you think it might be. Sometimes it's just the human type of things that, you know, any organization, even if you're a terrorist organization, you have some of the same human issues that you have in any organization. So folks can be motivated by a number of things. Ideology, they can be motivated by money, they can be motivated by glory. There's a number of different motivations. And that's interesting. That's not a science by any means, but there's people who specialize in it. And then intent. What are they intending to do? You know, what are these threatening organizations? Are they trying to kill people? Are they trying to get on the news? Are they interested in symbolic things? You know, are they more interested in hitting the Statue of Liberty than a cornfield in Iowa? You know, are they interested in symbolic things? Are they interested in certain dates? Are they interested in certain, you know, what is sort of their intent? Because those dates have resonance back to their communities. So on the threat side, on the intelligence side, we look at capability, motivation, and intent. Any questions? Feel free to interrupt with any questions as we go. I'll try to remember to pause and ask questions, and I will repeat the questions so people who are attending this virtually can understand it and hear it.
I have a question about complexity. I mean, you have an enormous number of people who could have left a company, for instance, and would have motivation to do something, and it may be almost impossible to determine which people may be maliciously motivated. How can you deal with that much complexity or that much data? How do you refine that in a reasonable amount of time?
Well, typically the organizations we work with, you know, have full-time security staffs, including companies, that are tracking you know, particular, you know, they're flagging people, anyone who, you know, they usually have exit interviews, they're they have their managers instructed to, you know, flag anyone who they think is exiting in a in a disgruntled fashion, and they're tracking that stuff. That's very typical in corporate America to keep track of, you know, who's leaving in a disgruntled, and in other organizations, to keep track of who's leaving is disgruntled. As far as people who, you know, infiltrate your organization, you know, as far as like terrorist groups and those sort of things, that's a different thing, and there's a whole field, you know, called counterintelligence that works on that that we really aren't going to talk about in this forum, but there are other ways to do that. And then at the most extreme, you know, for example, at our laboratory, you can, you know, have polygraph tests and other things like that. All right, so threat, capability, motivation, intent. Let me move to the next piece, vulnerability. So when we look at vulnerability, not necessarily going to have enough room to do this, but let me see if I click that, is that going to do what I think? Oh, yeah. I almost get this. All right, computer science degree coming in handy. All right, so vulnerability. The first thing we look at is external reconnaissance. So open source. So we're going to look at everything. We have teams that look at everything that we can find in the open source. You're going to look in the financial press. We're going to come at it from, you know, anything that's ever been printed about these folks, you know, LexisNexis searches, you know, down to the more technical stuff like the penetration people were talking about before, just finding out, you know, what pieces of the address space they own, what companies they're working with, who they have business relationships. We have a team that'll be working to map all of that out, what's available from the open source. The second piece, and the reason we call that a vulnerability is because, you know, we then go in later in the report and tell the company, you know, what they need to do to remove that. I mean, you just find stunning things on the open source. I mean, these companies will publish, you know, quarterly reports where if you take the photos, they have guys sitting there in the pictures of the photos with the passwords to key systems sitting right in the photos on their quarterly report that they're sending out. So, you know, there's plenty of stuff. You'd be shocked what you find in the open source. Or stuff that people reveal, for example, a lot of vendors to companies like to brag, oh, you know, they just did work for, say, Microsoft, for example. You know, hey, we just got this big contract working for, you know, some big impressive, you know, corporate 100 company, and look what we did, and they print the whole architecture. You'd be surprised just how much stuff. We get entire architectures, entire senses of everything that's going on inside this company because some company just put in the physical security system, and they want to put up a white paper and brag it up on that. So open source is the first place we start. And we try to, you know, teach companies to restrict all that open source stuff, and to create organizations and people in their organizations to review and release that, make sure they track what goes on the website, what people say publicly, what speakers are saying, et cetera. Because we'll go pull up, you know, anywhere anyone's ever spoke about the company or with the company, et cetera, we'll pull up. The next task of the vulnerability, and the reason I call them tasks is I have task leaders on my teams doing each of these things. So if I say that, that's what I mean by that. The next task we call cyber architecture. And so this is the group that's working with all those boxes and crates and files of stuff that came in with all the cyber architecture, where the firewalls are, what intrusion detection systems they have, you know, the entire computer security apparatus that they, how they're handing out passwords, what their dual authentication looks like, what their wireless systems look like, what their policies, where they allow people to get onto their networks, et cetera, if they've got some sort of layered defense, what it looks like. So the cyber architecture team looks at that. And when they go on site, they're the clipboard guys. They're going to go around and go to meetings with all the cybersecurity people at the facility, ask them a lot of questions, write down all the answers, et cetera. So that's the cyber architecture group. Then we have another group. Well, now that I know how to erase, I'm going to go crazy. So we have another group that's, just to conserve space here, that's the cyber penetration group. No, it's going fine, yeah. It's working, yeah. Okay, so cyber penetration. The cyber penetration group is a totally different sort of group. So the cyber architecture group has all those crates of information. They prepare for weeks, months, whatever, before we go there. Then when they land in the field, they've got questions they're ready to ask. They're asking very specific questions, right? You know, hey, we looked over all your network diagrams. We think you have vulnerabilities here. Explain this to us. How do you configure those firewalls? What does all this look like, et cetera, et cetera. The cyber penetration team, exact opposite. So they're starting with zero knowledge. They're playing terrorist, right? They're starting with nothing. They're building building everything up from 100% open source. They don't know anything. I put one card in the room. Did I drift off camera there? Sorry. I put one card in the room, trying to be dynamic, but I guess that doesn't work in this world. I put one card in the room for the cyber penetration folks, and that card has the name of the target, and that's it. They built everything up from the name of the target. So, you know, you could be in Afghanistan building this up, you could be in Cleveland building this up. They build it all up out of open source, over the internet, and that's what they start with. And so we're looking at both things. We want to do a comprehensive job of going through all their security and understanding what their security problems are. And we also want to play terrorist and understand really what could someone do starting with nothing, given just that target name, how much could they build up and how far could they penetrate in. So the penetration team, starting with nothing, builds up the open source reconnaissance and then actually hacks in to the facility and tries to take over things and gain information, etc. Now we have a parent
question. Is the facility put on the alert when this is going on, or is it business as usual for them?
It's all part of the rules of engagement, the ROE. So most facilities, and we recommend this, would prefer not to put the facility on alert because we want to test their response. So, for example, and this will get into a little technical stuff, but when we start doing the scans and the sort of exploits that we're going to do, we're going to start low and in a stealth mode. We're going to set up a whole bunch of servers from a whole bunch of directions. They're not going to know where it's coming from. We're going to leak it out over time and do it slowly, and we want to see if they catch that. And then we're going to ratchet it up as the days and weeks go on and see where's the threshold. Where do they understand that someone is scouting them, someone's attacking them, etc. So that's how we do it if we're not informed. If they are informed, then you lose that. You don't get to see what the thresholds are, what triggers it, why they missed it, and what their response is. Do they have an effective response? How do they communicate to their people? How do they shut it down? How do they shut the attack down? How much forensics do they gather on you? How able and quick are they to trace it back, what we call attribution? How fast can they determine who we are and where we're coming from, et cetera? So that's kind of how we play that. So we prefer that they not tell the inside because you gain a lot more information. I mean, one of the things that I'm probably a little obsessed with is gaining as much information for the least amount of effort possible. You know, every time we spend money or do effort, let's try to, you know, leverage it eight ways from Sunday. And so that's my take on that. Good question. Anything else? Okay, we'll keep going. So we have a parallel system for physical. So for physical, we have a physical sort of architecture team that's looking at gates, guards, guns, badges, cameras, sensing systems, whatever they've got in the facility, and they're going to get all those crates of information with the entire layout of where every sensor is, where everything is. Then we also have a penetration effort. Those guys are going to work at totally zero knowledge, right? They're going to go out and try to buy the uniforms, fake the badges, talk their way in, social engineer information out, whatever it can take, whatever they can do to penetrate the facility, see how far they can get into the facility, etc. So it's the same parallel system that we have on the cyber side. Then we have an OPSEC team. OPSEC, does that mean anything to anyone here, or has that been mentioned in the class?
Operational security,
great. So that comes out of the military, and it's, you know, we've done a lot of work for the military, obviously. And what OPSEC is basically, in a nutshell, is what can someone do by observing you in order to compromise you? Right, so the typical sorts of things that an OPSEC team is going to do is, well, first of all, you know, the favorite is dumpster diving, right? We're going to go through all their trash that's coming out of there and see what we can find. You know, computers that we can get information off of, throwing away pieces of paper they didn't shred. I mean, there's a lot of dumpster diving. There's a lot of staking out the organization and just understanding when guard shifts change and seeing what you can see through binoculars with, you know, through windows. You'd be surprised how many very secure facilities you can sit in the woods somewhere and look right in and see everything on their screens and what they're doing, et cetera. So this isn't high tech. You know, we don't have to do all the kind of stuff you see in movies. You know, we can do trickier things like follow employees to lunch, then maybe have the cyber penetration team create a problem back there. So once we've sort of broke out their org chart and tried to understand, you know, who are the important people, who might have key passwords, who might have key information, you know, then create an issue back at the facility. So now this guy gets a call on his cell phone. He doesn't want to go from lunch, or his kid's soccer game is another great one to do this on. He doesn't want to leave the daughter's, you know, recital or whatever. So he's going to give that password over the cell phone, or he's going to give that piece of information over there. So the OPSEC team looks at things like that. You know, pose as a third grade class, right? Write a letter in and say, hey, give me a big shiny, you know, the third grade class, I'm Mrs., you know, Hannigan, and, you know, we want something big and shiny and colorful. You know, could you send us something like that for the nice little kids at the school? And so, of course, they'll send beautiful network diagrams or whatever sitting around because they don't have any policy, you know, they don't have any way to control that. So those are the sort of, and, you know, other things like pick up backup tapes. You know, a lot of these people go to, like, Iron Mountain or someone, so you can pose as a backup tape person and pick up backup tapes, things like that. So OPSEC things. Next team is interdependencies. Okay, so interdependencies. One thing I like to say is, for example, the electric power grid runs on water. So what do I mean by that? The electric power grid, obviously, to you guys, probably doesn't run on water. And occasionally doesn't run here in California. But the reason I say the electric power grid runs on water is because of interdependencies. So I could do all this work to try to take down the U.S. power grid, right? Or I could do all this work to try to get penetration teams into the internal control rooms that are controlling these facilities, physical penetration. I could do a lot of work trying to hack into these places. Or I could just cut the water, because they need water for the chillers that cool the rooms that have the computers. So I'll go three blocks away where there's no security, you know, disable the water main or blow up the water main. Now they can't cool the rooms, all the computers overheat, and I take down the power grid that way. So we're looking at interdependencies. We're looking at interdependencies. What is this facility interdependent on from an infrastructure standpoint, and what other facilities are dependent on it? How critical is it, this particular facility or whatever organization we're looking at? What other groups need it? How important is it to take out? And then the final thing we do is P&P. That's policies and procedures. And the reason we do this is basically root cause analysis. A lot of the problems that you find, a lot of these vulnerabilities that I've been talking about here that we find are ultimately, you know, the way you're going to fix them is through some sort of policy or procedure, or the way that it got to that state is because people don't have good policies and procedures, or people are ignoring the policies and procedures because they're hard to implement, not well understood, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that's the V. So we've done T, and we've done V. So let's do C. So that's consequences. And consequences is basically impact analysis. What consequences would you generate if a threat actor accessed certain vulnerabilities? What consequences would they generate? And industry is actually, you know, pretty good at this, and government a little less so, but industry is very good at this because they're very interested in, you know, operations, being up 24/7, you know, if it's a factory or if any sort of facility is interested in, you know, staying operational. So they've actually usually done not so much work on vulnerability, usually no work on threat except for military folks and a few other people. But they've usually done a lot on consequences, and they know a lot about consequences. So once we present threats and vulnerabilities to them and show them pathways, they can go, oh my God, not only could you generate that consequence, but here's three other consequences that would generate, cascading effects, things like that. So that's looking at impact. The only tricky thing here is a lot of industry and government facilities, just a terminology thing, they call what we would call, let me say it this way, what they call security, we call safety. So this used to confuse me a lot when I would go into companies or organizations. They would say, oh, we have a security department, and you'd go over there, and they were doing nothing with security. They were doing what you'd basically call safety or reliability. So they're not looking at, you know, coordinated attack. They're just looking at sort of a 100-year flood, you know, things that are more statistical in nature, that, hey, every 100 years it floods, so let's make sure that we build the dam this high or whatever. They're not looking at anyone doing, you know, blowing up the two dams downstream and getting that force to wipe out the dam here, et cetera. So they're not looking at coordinated attack or any sort of intelligent attack. So that's TVC, consequence. And then the last thing we do is risk assessment. And so that's where we bring all the, what I call the apples, oranges, and Volkswagens together into a risk assessment. So you have your threats, you have your vulnerabilities, you have your consequences. No one really cares about that. The decision makers, you know, that's a lot of technical gobbledygook to them. They want to know, you know, what are the risks? What are the trade-offs, you know, versus putting a better lock on that door or a better background investigation on her versus better cybersecurity on this, you know, laptop that we're using here. They want to know what gets them more benefit, what's more bang for buck. So we're going to answer, you know, different slices for them there. What are the top 10 things they can do that would have the biggest reduction in risk? We're going to say if money was, they might want to know, sometimes board of directors or decision makers want to know, if money was no object, tell me the three biggest things we could do to reduce vulnerabilities or to mitigate consequences, et cetera. So those are the sort of questions that we answer in the risk characterization. So pre-assessment, the assessment, and I guess you can't see that, so I have to draw on the screen. So assessment, and then we have post-assessment. That's the usual stuff. We do reports, presentations, implementation assistance. Sometimes we need to help people fix the problems. They don't have the technical staff on site to do that. We try to refine our methodology all the time, capture lessons learned, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that's, and I just give you that for a little bit of background of what we were doing probably for the first 4 years that I led the program. That was the basic method that we were doing. So now I'm going to talk about what happened after that and talk a little bit about the Department of Homeland Security and how the National Laboratories got involved in DHS, et cetera. The National Laboratories got involved with the Department of Homeland Security and working on these counterterrorism issues due to some pretty unique capabilities. We have the deep functional areas. So we have people who understand most of these areas that could be attacked. So we have people who understand the vulnerabilities, who understand the consequences. We have consequence modeling. And then the key thing is we can fuse that with classified intelligence, other threat information, and have pretty good methodological and analytical capacity to assess and integrate that. So that's sort of how we got involved with these bigger kind of national assessments, where we got away from looking at particular infrastructures, cities, regions, et cetera, and started looking at national level things for DHS as it was stood up. So the next thing I want to talk about is what to defend against and why. So what customers like the Department of Homeland Security are interested in is, you know, even though we've done like large multi-state infrastructures, for example, metropolitan level assessments, entire cities where we looked at all kinds of things simultaneously, you know, when you're looking at, it didn't scale to really what DHS was looking at. I mean, they're really looking at what to protect in big regions of lots of cities, you know, what it's protecting those assets against, and have those decisions supported by some sort of rational system that, you know, quantifiable where possible will allow for the analysis of those trade-offs and yet be creative enough to avoid surprise from novel attacks. So let's make sure we just don't get so locked into some rigid system like the government sometimes does that we totally aren't thinking out of the box on novel attack. So even though the ultimate deliverable remains the same for the work we were doing before, you know, you want to matrix the highest consequence vulnerabilities versus the most important key assets in the region. I mean, now you have a bigger breadth of threats, vulnerabilities, and consequence across a wider swath of geography, and you need to synthesize and integrate those into some sort of assessment method. And you know, the approach that we had to come up with had to be plastic enough to represent a variety of ways that let me just give an example, like from critical infrastructure, that, you know, it could appear in a lot of ways in this sort of assessment. It could appear as an asset. Obviously, we need electric power, oil, gas, water, telecommunications, etc. It can be a target. It can be a weapon. You know, those chlorine tanks can be weaponized. I mean, a lot of things can be weaponized. So you're looking at things as assets, as targets, as weapons, as carriers. You can use the water supply to carry attacks to things. You can use airplanes to carry attacks to things, the transportation sector. It's part of the detection response system, and it's interdependent with a lot of those other functions. So it's a pretty big challenge when you think of all the ways things can be purposed. So let me just quickly read to you sort of the guidance that I gave to my team as we were working this. Actually, let me skip that because we're rolling on time. So let me skip ahead here to what I call the key pieces on the board. So now let me see if I can That's a big eraser. Oh, erased, did exactly what I wanted. Good deal. Okay, so I just skipped through a bunch of stuff, but basically we convened a group and looked at all the different types of assessments we'd been doing over the previous years and what methodologies we've been using on them and a bunch of methodologies that other folks were using in the military and other places, and tried to distill out several of the key pieces that were going to need to be on the game board as we saw it for any sort of assessment that we were going to do. And so I can sum it all up in one system here, or one sentence here, which is will mean nothing to you and everything to my team, which is KAOPS TVC Saberni Psi-Z CIC FUD. That's all you need to know. But let me break it down for you. So let's start with KAOPS. So basically, if you look at all the different vulnerability assessments, threat assessments, consequence assessments we're doing, the five key pieces, the first key piece is key assets. What are you defending? You have to know what you're defending. We can't just try to defend the entire nation against everything, against everyone. What are the key assets in operation? It can be sites, operations, services, populations, materiel, information. Elements of that are often dynamic, so you know we build big databases of population shifts within, if we're doing a big metropolitan area, you know, populations have daily patterns, people go to work, they congregate at certain places, there are seasonal patterns, etc. So what are the key assets and operations? What are we defending? Secondly, what are we defending against? So we're defending against threats, vulnerabilities, and consequences. So actors that can access vulnerabilities in order to generate consequences. Third key piece what we call Saberni Psi-Z. Saberni, anyone know what that means? Chem bio rad nu high explosive. So those are the WMD categories, chem, bio, rad, nuke, high explosive. It's a way to generate large consequences. A couple of other ways to generate large consequences that we add is cyber, because we've done a lot of work on generating large consequences through cyber, and then Z. The Z we have in there to represent lesser known, classified, or unknown ways to generate large consequences. So that's the third piece of our five key pieces. The next is critical infrastructure. It's starting to get more press, but a lot of people hadn't been thinking about it and still aren't thinking about it carefully enough. But it's a vast array of infrastructure. It's defined as everything from electric power to oil to gas to telecommunications, financial, etc. And I can give entire lectures on that. And the last piece of the five key pieces as we looked over everything is what we call CFUD. And what CFUD stands for is, and I'll cheat off my paper because I can never spell this word, casualties, economic, iconic, and fear, uncertainty, doubt. Okay, so what does that mean? Casualties obviously is injury and death to people. Economic is obviously economic impacts. Iconic are things that are symbolic, have symbolic value. I mean, there's a reason that the 9/11 attackers attacked the World Trade Center. They're interested in things with, they're interested in things like economic hegemony and world trade and things like that. So even though Americans might not have thought of the World Trade Center, I mean, they might have thought of the White House or something else as a more iconic thing, to the attackers, they were interested in things that are iconic to them. And finally, fear, uncertainty, doubt, that's sort of sowing, if you do things like poison water supplies, now people are afraid to drink water, it's items like that. So these are basically principal ways to define dimensions of consequence, to categorize assets, to analyze threat, intent, and motivation. So thinking in terms of CFUD allows, you know, our team members to see a region as being composed of specific adversary attractors, for example, population concentrations, stadiums, public transportation, economic centers, financial and business sectors, symbolic targets, so names and images associated, now remember, not in our minds necessarily, but in the minds of the adversaries with American power, American way of life, etc., and then what we call FUD hubs, things like schools, you know, if you kill children, it's much different if you kill military people versus if you're killing children. That is a much different sort of fear, uncertainty, doubt thing. If you get at the food supply, the water supply, things like that sow a lot of fear, uncertainty, doubt. All right. So let me talk about, I'll erase all that. And let me just talk about, let me work through an example so you can get a little sense of what this works like in the real world here as we go out and do these things. So typically, let's say we would go out to a facility or an area or a region. We look at key assets, as I said, sites, operations, etc. Look at things, you know, as targets, as weapons, as consequence transmitters, as consequence multipliers, detection response elements, etc. So, for example, people can be viewed as a target, and they're more valuable as a target maybe if they're concentrated in groups. People can be a weapon. They're suicide bombers. They can be unwitting carriers of biological threats. They can provide concealment, etc. They can be a consequence multiplier, you know, chaotic masses impede ingress and egress from various scenes. People make up part of the response structure, etc. So that's just an example. There's a lot of different key assets. Threats, as we talked about, so first of all, we're going to find out what the key assets are. Then we're going to look at the threat. So we're going to break down threat, if you remember, into capability, intent, and motivation. So if we look at capability, we want to know, you know, what does the adversary have knowledge about, access to, or ability to deploy chemical weapons, biological weapons. You're taking the things that I talked about before from the five keys. You're looking at things like Saberni. You're looking at capabilities like cyber. You're looking at unknown or classified things. You're looking at critical infrastructure things. Those are some of the capabilities we're looking at on the threat side. From the intent side, what are they interested in doing? You know, this is where things like CFUD come in. Are they interested in generating casualties, economic impact? Are they interested in iconic or specific targets they have in mind? You know, we're trying to understand, are they interested in sowing fear, uncertainty, doubt, et cetera. And then motivation, I talked about that some. So next we look at vulnerabilities. So again, looking at... already talked about that. So vulnerabilities, using these same sort of five key pieces, vulnerabilities, you're looking at some of the same things, right, that we talked about here. You know, vulnerabilities to chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and high explosives attack, vulnerabilities to cyber attack, and other attacks like that. And we also throw in all hazard attacks, so natural, accidental, chemical spills, earthquakes, tsunami, all that sort of stuff as well. And then consequences can also be expressed in terms of these exact same five key pieces. So, for example, in an assessment, we might look at CFUD consequences. So how many people would be killed by this consequence? What sort of economic impact? What would the symbolic, iconic impact be? And what sort of fear, uncertainty, doubt would that sow? So how much more time do I?
We better wrap it up.
Okay.
Can I have a question from San Diego?
Yeah, why don't we do that? Why don't we take whatever questions there are
okay.
For about 2 minutes? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Actually, it's a an observation and two questions. Maybe you can address them quickly. You've addressed a lot of dimensions of vulnerability and assessment, but it seems to me that there are even many more things like how one's publicity apparatus addresses the problem. Or how you can recover from a data outage with perhaps redundant alternate sites, and so on. And, you know, the list goes on and on and on. Question is, first of all, how do who sponsors these kinds of things, and what are they expecting of this assessment? And the second question is, do you get to go back and see what changes your assessments have caused?
So to answer your second question first, yes, we do go back. I wish we had a better program at that through the government. There's a lot of changes of programs as the years go by, and there isn't the perfect through line of continuity that you'd like to see on some of the programs in the government. But we do go back, and you know, we have been back to various facilities around the... I mean, we've been working 28 different states and been back to a lot of those facilities multiple times to see how much they've improved. Their management's interested in that as well, and metrics for that sort of improvement. And your first question was about who sponsors this work? Who sponsors the work? Department of Homeland Security, Department of Energy, FAA, Department of Interior, military, intelligence agencies, companies themselves are very interested in knowing their own vulnerabilities very quietly, so they would sponsor as well.
So So I have a question. This sounds like emptying out the ocean with coffee spoons. About how many targets or objects or whatever would you have to look at to span the United States in a way of sort of major targets that would make the newspapers? And how many, what percentage of those can we realistically imagine, let alone do something about?
Well, that was actually the next section I was going to come to, which is called cutdowns, which I didn't talk about. So we have a lot of cutdown methodologies to try to cut that down. And so maybe I'll just try to blow through that quickly. We started with what I would call VCT cutdown. We started with vulnerabilities. Go out and find a bunch of vulnerabilities, figure out what consequences, you know, they generate, and then do threat, you know, whatever threat you can get on the back end. Well, that doesn't work because you can find, like you said, teaspoon out of the sea. You can find vulnerabilities for miles, like the cyber guy was just cyber alone. You can, Microsoft alone, cyber alone. You can find vulnerabilities for miles. So we pretty quickly got away from that and went to CVT. So started working the problem backwards. Let's start with the consequences. What are the biggest consequences we can generate in this region? And then after these are like filters. Let's start with the consequences. Then after we've cut down on consequences, only look at the vulnerabilities that, you know, generate those consequences. And then only look at the threat actors who have access to those vulnerabilities that could generate those consequences. That still was too much. So, and this, I'm going over like a 9-year period here, but so then we went to CAWCVT, which is starting with that critical assets workshop, which I didn't get into in too much detail, but it's a pretty big workshop looking at a lot of dimensions of things and bringing in a lot of different people, as I talked about. And the goal of that workshop is to do as much of a pre-filter as possible to really focus the teams. You know, as I said, even the CVT is a lot. So to really focus the teams that are doing CVT down on just the most critical assets. And then ultimately, you know, what we'd like to do is probably do CAW and then threat, as in, you know, figure out what capability all the people were tracking from an intelligence standpoint, filter out on that, and then only look at the consequences and vulnerabilities of those groups. The problem with that is that that's a little risky because our threat information can be dodgy and we're not tracking every group. So even though this is sort of the ideal, we're basically doing this. So a really structured program to bring in a whole set of folks from a lot of different perspectives and filter down on critical assets, then filter down on consequences, then filter vulnerabilities, then do threat on the back end.
So when you do that, how many files do you have? How many locations or things, objects that you identify and start prioritizing?
It would totally depend on what sort of assessment. If we were doing like an electric power grid versus like we're doing a 34 city area in down in Los Angeles right now, it would really depend. Let me just say let's take a 34 city region. I didn't get to that, but I was going to talk a little bit about that because we had to come up with an even. I gotcha. So I didn't talk about that, but we had to come up with an even more even more stringent cutdown methodology for that. But we probably started with a matrixy of, you know, potentially tens of thousands of things to work with and cut down from there. And in the end, you know, we had it down to a list of 20. And that's for a 1,000 square mile region with a lot of stuff going on in it.
All right. I want to thank everybody for their patience. I know we're a little over. Are there other questions in Washington or Microsoft or San Diego?
Could you tell us a couple examples of those 20? I'm just trying to get a sense of the scale.
No.
Thank you.